Good morning, everyone. I understand that there'll be more people coming in. Apparently, 35W is rather blocked up. I don't know how many of you had to experience the slippery ice over the weekend. I wasn't sure I was going to get home Saturday night with the black ice, but welcome. I think this is going to be a very interesting day for all of you. As you know, I'm Brian Atwood, the Dean of the Humphrey School. We are going to be changing our name to school starting in January, so get used to it. Not easy after all these years of being the Institute, but I'm really delighted that to have a couple of old friends from USAID who've new affiliations, but who asked if we would put this conference together. We have such talent here at the University of Minnesota, and it's a wonderful place in the middle of the country to consider issues like global health and food security. Steve Morrison is the Director of Global Health Policy and at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Worked with Steve at USAID. I can remember him setting up camps for, or at least doing the intellectual work and setting up reintegration camps for military people in places like Mozambique and other things with the Office of Transitions Initiatives. And Alex Palacios, who is Special Representative of the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations. And Alex and I did a lot of work together on Capitol Hill trying to convince people that they should vote for foreign aid. And we're still standing, despite all of the bruises and scars that we have from that. And that, of course, is going to be a major issue in the new Congress. So it'll be very interesting to see if we can once again pull together a bipartisan coalition to support U.S. Foreign assistance programs. These two initiatives that we're going to discuss today focus on issues that the administration is also focusing on, the Obama administration. There is a new global health initiative, and there is a new initiative called Feed the Future. It's related to food security. Now, these issues obviously affect millions of people in poor countries, but they also affect Americans too, as we will learn today. The administration is, this last week at least, started briefing the Congress on the quadrennial review of diplomacy and development. I had an opportunity last week in preparation for my new position, the chair of the Development Assistance Committee, to meet with several people at USAID and state. And a lot of really tough decisions have been made about the QDDR. You can well imagine that when there is a discussion within an administration about who should do what, that it's not easy ever. It's a matter of jurisdiction. It's a matter of deciding who can best implement a program in global health, who can best implement a program in food security. When you think about global health, you think immediately probably of Health and Human Services, the government department, or you may think about the Communicable Disease Center, the CDC. You rarely think about USAID. The question becomes, in both cases, food security, where you would obviously think about the Department of Agriculture, who has the capacity to actually implement these programs on the ground? Who has the capacity to think about development, sustainable development? And these two initiatives, I think, risk the possibility that they will be sort of vertical interventions in societies that may push out a number of other interventions that could be mutually reinforcing. And I think that's going to be one of the discussions that we'll have today. How do we actually continue an initiative which has been very successful to immunize those millions of children who haven't yet been immunized. We know the sad facts about the number of children that are dying. Obviously, food security and nutrition is an important aspect of that as well. How does the U.S. government, and this is going to be a focus of today's discussions, effectively operate in these areas and at the same time pursue enduring development in the poor parts of the world, which is an increasingly salient issue. It's been characterized as a national security issue. And you can see it when you think about the world financial recession. You see it when you hear about food prices soaring and riots occurring in places like Egypt and Indonesia and other places where people are spending a much higher percentage of their income on food. And you see it when you look closely at families who are losing children to diseases that would otherwise be curable in the Western countries. These are the kinds of issues we're going to discuss today. The University of Minnesota is very proud to host Gavi and the Center for Strategic and International Studies and their initiatives in this area. We are, I think, excellent partners for this because we have initiatives underway here as well. The Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy with Mike Osterholm is the director, is part of the Academic Health Center at the university. And its mission is to reduce illness and death from infectious disease and to look at the threats not only to people in the developing world, but also threats to Americans. We have the university's most famous alumni probably is Norman Borlaug, who received the Nobel Prize for his work in the Green Revolution. And we continue to have a major center here on food security and are very active, particularly this year, with the Foreign Agriculture Organization. This obviously is a farm state with wonderfully big companies like Cargill and many others, and I'm not going to. We have some people here who will be representing some of those companies on our panels today, and Land O'Lakes, for example. And so we have a real interest in this from the University of Minnesota, one of the great research universities in the world, and we have many, many people from the developing world who matriculate here at this university. I'm going to stop there. And ask Steve Morrison to come forward to introduce the first panel. As I said, Steve and I work together at USAID. He's now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Steve, please come forward.
Thank you, Brian, and good morning. I'll say a few opening remarks about how we're going to approach this panel. I'll introduce our panelists, and then we'll assemble and get going. Brian, thank you so much for welcoming us all here. Brian has been a hero for many of us who have worked on these issues of development over the years. His tenure in leading USAID during the Clinton administration was the longest running leadership position at AID during a period that was a very rugged period. It included the 94-95 transition, and we survived thanks to, in large measure, to Brian's indefatigable determination to make sure that the development agenda survived. And we're at another big moment of transition now in terms of our fiscal crisis and the shift of governance and power in Washington, many of these same issues and lessons learned that we went through in 94, 95 are now in front of us, and I expect we'll hear more about that. I want to, before starting, I want to give special thanks to the staff here at the school who have been so supportive of us in pulling this together, to Johanna Nesseth and Kristen Wedding from our CSIS, and from some of our close friends, Alex Palacios, Trevor Gunn, who've made it a special trip to be here with us. I run a center on global health policy at CSIS, which has been around for a couple of years. It has run a commission over the last year, the Commission on Smart Global Health Policy, which brought together 25 very prominent opinion leaders from America and from beyond America, looking at what a long-term 15-year strategic approach around global health might look like. And there's a number of products. There's a very elaborate and active website, smartglobalhealth.org. We have gone around the country to many different places, like we are here today, to try to interact with university leadership, with the business sector, with elected political officials, with implementers and advocates who really represent the new face in America, the new face of global health. We had very successful events of this kind in Seattle, in Boston, in the Research Triangle in New York, in the Bay Area. And so this is one of a string of events that we have held over the last year to have these kinds of framed discussions that are meant to be very interactive. And I'm hoping that we can cover the ground quickly and then hear from you as part of this. And the videotape from this session will be posted on our respective organizations' websites, and we'll be welcoming further comment from that. Some general remarks. In the last decade, we've had a remarkable transformation in the U.S. leadership position taken on global health. Today, the U.S. commitments outside our borders focus principally around HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria, but increasingly looking beyond those three amounts to our global health annual commitments amount to almost $10 billion per year. That's roughly 30% of our overseas development assistance. That is a remarkable and very surprising transformation that we experienced in this last decade. There are many reasons that drove that forward. The HIV-AIDS pandemic and its visibility and power in the beginning of the at the end of the 90s and into this next decade was most fundamental. White House leadership was very fundamental. The emergence of new advocates, the faith-based sector in America, the Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation, Bono. There was a convergence of many different partners who came together, including the business sector, which began to embrace global health in new forms. And we saw in Congress the emergence of a space, a very special bipartisan space in support of global health that made it possible to have these massive expansions. When President Bush put forward the proposal in January of 2003 for a 15-year, $15 billion five-year program on HIV/AIDS, this was the single largest public health initiative in history. Congress embraced that, and in fact, the first 5 years, the actual expenditures were $22 billion, and that's unheard of. It's staggering, and one has to go back to the base of support that was created within Congress. Now, today, what we face really is a question of where do we go from here? The fiscal environment has become much more difficult and uncertain. The go-go days of the last decade are beyond us, and we're now in a period of low growth, of the possibility of regression in budgets. We face a debt and deficit crisis here at home that is, as we will see, begin to impinge. How do we sustain our progress? How do we sustain the support of the American people? How do we build out the voice of the business sector, of the community that stands behind an ethical and faith-based argument of the human interest that we have around these issues? of those who have made the security argument that this is very important to U.S. national interests. Agenda that we're going to look at, we'll be talking a lot about the President's Global Health Initiative, which attempts to sustain the HIV, TB, and malaria, and move that out to begin to encompass maternal and child health, family planning, and health systems, and to put a focus on neglected tropical diseases. But there are other dimensions also that we'll be hearing about this morning, including the pandemic flu preparedness, what kind of scientific and research agenda, and what about emerging chronic disorders, the non-communicable diseases that we see now emerging with great speed in the low and middle income countries. The experts that have kindly agreed to be with us this morning, I'll just quickly introduce them and then we'll move over and we'll start off in this order. Michael Osterholm, familiar to many of you here from his work at the University of Minnesota. He's the professor here and the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research. He's a national personality that was very influential in trying to, during the earlier periods of SARS, H5N1, H1N1, and many other challenges around food safety, has been a prominent personality interpreting what the facts are and what they mean and what the U.S. government should be doing. He has been very instrumental in trying to guide thinking about what kind of disease surveillance and response system over the long term needs to be created both within our own borders and in partnership with others outside. Alex Palacios is here with us today, the special representative for the Gavi Alliance. Gavi Alliance is one of the most promising and successful alliances formed a decade ago with the mission of raising funds and getting out to countries that have good national plans, ample new vaccines that can save the lives of children and mothers and others around the world. He's been with Gavi since 2002. He was with UNICEF for a six-year period prior to that, and prior to that worked at USAID Peace Corps. Patsy Stinchfield, another personality that you are familiar with, is the director for infectious disease, immunology, and control at the Children's Immunization Project as part of the Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. So we're very pleased that we have a very distinguished nurse practitioner with deep vaccine experience here in this state. Questions around how do you gain access to difficult-to-reach populations? How do you sustain popular confidence in that effort? And what does that mean when we look at the global challenges? The fourth panelist we have with us is Trevor Gunn. He's the Senior Director for International Relations for Medtronic based here in this area. He's a close friend based out of Washington. Prior to joining Medtronic, was involved in business information services in countries that were emerging as newly independent states after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. He is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and a graduate, a PhD at the London School of Economics. So please join me in welcoming our four panelists. I'd like to ask them all to come up and we'll get moving. So I've asked each of our panelists to hit some of the highlights, high points in their presentations, and we'll move through them in sequence. Then we'll come back and have a roundtable discussion, and then open the floor for your comments and questions. Mike, do you want to kick things off?
Thank you, Steve, and thank you very much for the invitation to be here today. I'd be remiss if I didn't first acknowledge Brian and his many contributions to this institution. We wish you well on your new journey, and thank you very much for what you've done for us and what you continue to do for the world. We were all asked to give a very brief opening introduction, and let me just say that obviously I'm supposed to address pandemics, but let me give a context, I think, to today's entire proceedings, and that is the fact of what is failure and what is success. And I find that that is a very confusing issue when it comes to health, because frankly, every one of us in this room are going to die. We're all going to die someday. And if we eliminate the current top 10 causes of death, we'll have 10 new ones. And I'm not sure that the 10 new ones are going to be any better than the 10 we have. So that, in effect, we have always had a system based on what we don't want to have happen, but we don't really base it on what we want to have happen, which if you ran a business that way, you'd be in deep trouble. If you ran any number of programs, you'd be in deep trouble. But in health, we do. So I think today that one of the questions we have to raise and ask ourselves, what is success? And to me, success is once someone is born, they have the opportunity for a long, productive, pain-free life. And then, in that last moment when they die of something that was painless, that did not cause great disability, we celebrated that event and not thought of it as a failure. I can look no further than the world of influenza, and when a 87-year-old individual who has been restrained in a bed for the last 12 months to protect themselves from themselves die from influenza, in public health we count that as a death. When a 22-year-old pregnant woman who otherwise has no underlying health problems dies from influenza, we count that as a death. And we don't distinguish between the two. Our numbers are, they died. I would suggest that today the questions we need to ask ourselves are, when are those deaths successes and when are they failures? And all the programs we're talking about today should be measured against that very point. So, for example, I begin with the fact that in my world of infectious diseases, I've come to understand that really it's all about physics. It's about those laws that cannot be violated as that they are set already in, you might say, the global cosmic stone. Death is, life and death is one of them. A second one that I think is very important, that as we look at the world of infectious diseases, we're up against microbial evolution. And we live today in a world where some parts of that world are no different than our world here in the United States was in the 1800s. Life expectancy in some of the countries in Africa today is no different. In fact, it's lower than it was right here. In 1900, the number one cause of death of children in the city of Minneapolis was typhoid fever from unsafe water. When Tesla came along and brought us electricity, and Edison added on to that, we suddenly had a revolution because now we could actually develop a water system where we could actually pump water. With that, we had the ability to have up sewer systems, so where we could actually contain that waste, which was now the, one of the number one problems. We invented refrigeration, so now that we could, in fact, have a safer food supply, we could actually invent things like vaccines because we had a way to manufacture them because of electricity. Well, now the world is getting electricity more and more, but we're not seeing the commensurate changes in some cases because of microbial evolution. The point being is that the bugs were here before us, and because they basically go through an evolution of every 20 to 30 minutes, depending on which species of bug infectious agent we're talking about, they genetically adapt to what we, in fact, as humans, take many, many generations to do. So antibiotic resistance, which I'll not talk about today, we are living off a reservoir of antibiotics that were created over the last generation and a half that we're losing. And anybody who knows today knows we are approaching a post-antibiotic era, which, I mean, we can't even fathom that concept. And yet, what does that mean for people's likely outcome through life? The issues around food, and I just have to say this because I know this, I'm not supposed to be talking about food today, but as somebody who looks at food security, because I deal a lot with foodborne diseases, but I look at it also as there. I was born and raised near the same small town that Norman Borlaug was born and raised in. Norman Borlaug has been a hero in all my life. But we have grossly overestimated the contribution that Norman Borlaug has made to what's happened in this world, and that's almost blasphemy to say at this institution. Some of us have actually tried to partition out the impacts that the Green Revolution have had on our food supply and why Paul Ehrlich was wrong in the 1970s. About a third of it clearly can be related to plant genetics, but a third of it was to tapping subterranean groundwater supplies around the world that today we're exhausting. And we're those semi-arid regions of the world that we basically for the last 40 years made into breadbaskets, we're losing. And the other third of it is, and I've been there, I've been in the ruralest of areas in Asia, And I've watched rice fields being fertilized by petrochemical-based fertilizers. I've watched herbicides and pesticides, which make a big difference, all from petrochemical. Well, peak oil is honest. And over the next 20 to 40 years, when peak oil means the fertilizers, herbicides, and pesticides are going to start diminishing in availability, or at least cost and availability, as well as the fact we run out of subterranean groundwater, food's going to become a tighter and tighter issue. And why do I say that? Because we already know we have food security problems today, but more importantly, world population. And that's the last law of physics I want to bring up about infectious diseases. You know, 6.8 to 6.9 billion people on the face of the earth today. One out of every nine people who's ever lived is on the face of the earth right now. And if we really have the projection to what might be 9 billion people, and we have to feed those people, we are actually in a physics curve that doesn't work. Potential for lower yields across the board with sustaining agriculture at the same time we need to feed more and more people. And from an infectious disease standpoint, my business, man, that's the perfect intersection if you want to really have a problem, is find a world that is not only impoverished, living in squalor conditions that even the Dickens would have been shocked at seeing, but now put on that a global food shortage supply with the lack of health in general. So I think we've got some issues today about success that is, first of all, if we really want to begin to address every one of the issues we're talking about, population control has to be at the heart of it. Don't talk to me about how you're going to increase food supplies, how we're going to increase access to medical care, how we're going to improve public health programs with vaccines if we don't embark upon a primary program of population control, because the population growth is outstripping our abilities in each of these areas to really adequately deal with it. I know, and Gavi is here, and I've welcomed so much what we've done on issues around vaccines and even HIV, but even PEPFAR, and at this very stage, I sat here and said 2 years ago, we would see a day when every day the difference between the number of people infected with HIV and the number of people we can treat will grow to the point of where the question will be raised, what are we really doing? And today, we have many more people in Africa every day that are infected than any of our programs are getting them on treatment with. So the question is, what else do we do? So let me just conclude my comments by saying I was supposed to raise a question about pandemics. And I think that pandemics are important. Pandemics are worldwide outbreaks of diseases. And influenza is by far the most notorious. But there are some fundamental issues we have to address even before we get to the world of pandemics. And that is, what are we going to measure and what do we call success? And what are we really going to do about it? And oftentimes we're good at applying Band-Aids. And Band-Aids are wonderful things for the short term and for that immediate individual. But the population-based issues are huge. And there is an intersection coming today that I see between microbial evolution, population growth, exhaustion of major resources in this world that we have used in the last three generations that together collide kind of in this cosmic asteroid hitting us. And until we start to really address those, I think that the issue of any one pandemic or any one disease is going to give us some short-term and, in some cases, very comfortable successes. But it won't address the big issue of really global health security, whether it be food, whether it be infectious agents, or any other issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Alex.
Thank you. Now I'm terribly worried. No, I appreciate it, and thanks very much from me as well to Brian and the team here for organizing this, and I always enjoy sharing the stage also with Steve and others at CSIS. I want to start talking about successes, and I think it's useful just to compare the two given Mike's comments, because I do think that when it comes to development, and particularly global health, we have the history of citing all these terrible statistics, and I think often being our own worst enemy, sort of creating a sense of doom and money down rat holes and so forth, that there's nothing we can do. The problem is just too large, too unsolvable. In fact, I think that the opposite is true, although there remain some major challenges, as Mike has noted. And I think that there is a relationship, and one that I particularly have followed, between some of these successes, although they're not fully consolidated, and population growth and getting down to sort of addressing some of the larger issues. So I'll talk about that in just a second. In fact, child mortality is down over the last decade, I think in a rather major way. almost 11 million deaths in 1999 and 2000, child deaths, children under the age of five. That's now down to less than 9 million deaths, about 8.8 million deaths reported by UNICEF and the World Health Organization last year. Measles deaths down 90% in sub-Saharan Africa, a really phenomenal level of success as a result of partnership and leadership and focus. Four out of five children today are now being reached with basic immunization, and DTP3, three injections of that routine vaccine, demonstrating, I think, an immunization system that is now more reliably delivering and which has the capacity to deliver even more. Polio, I think many of us know, already on the verge of eradication. From tens of thousands of cases at the beginning of the decade down to just a few dozen, and now really only four countries where there's endemic polio virus. Maternal mortality, to cover the M part of MCH, some success there, but much more needs to be done. I think that we now have data showing, in fact, that maternal mortality is significantly lower than was previously thought, but that's not the only reason. We have some sense of promise. There are more women today receiving antenatal care than ever before. The rural to urban gap is being narrowed. Again, a great deal of work still to be done, but some progress. And beyond MCH, Mike noted, there are more people today, many millions more, on antiretrovirals than at the beginning of the decade. I think we should take some good feeling of on that. And of course, in terms of malaria, we've seen through various programs the increasing protection of communities through insecticide-treated bed nets and the promise of a new vaccine, which is under development. I think there have been a number of factors associated with all of these successes in many different areas. Number one, partnership. I think one of the things that happened in the last decade is that increasingly the major organizations and partners from public to private to civil society to industry began working together, unlike in previous decades. I think that financing obviously is a big story. As Steve noted in his opening, there has been a great deal of money now made available to global health. But I think it's not just the level of money. I think the predictability of money has been a very important factor in the success. We know that for Gavi, where we are involved in the procurement and delivery of a commodity, of vaccines, that having a better sense of the resources that are coming over a longer period of time has tremendous influence on the vaccine market itself, but it also has influence at developing country level. We're seeing commitments by countries that we hadn't seen before, that level of predictability. I think there's been enormous leadership at global level. And that ranges from the G8 itself, keeping the development agenda alive over the last decade. Really began in a big way with Glenn Eagles, but continued beyond that. We have the G8, the UN Secretary General. We have finance ministers, I think, paying attention to development in addition to secretaries of state in a way that we hadn't seen in previous decades. And of course, one of the most important aspects of I think, success is a level of recognition of the importance of country ownership, and that recognition leading to the development of costed multi-year plans for development, for health, that have placed countries more appropriately at the center of the response to these challenges rather than as bystanders. On the challenges side, I think we have weak health systems, I would place at the very top of the agenda. We have some great solutions available to us today. I happen to work around vaccines, but I know that they are just but one, immunization is but one intervention that is relying on health systems that really need a tremendous level of shoring up. We have a lack of health workers overall, lack of sufficiently trained personnel. We have infrastructure in many developing countries, particularly the poorest countries, which is very spotty. For vaccines, the cold chain is incredibly important, yet that cold chain infrastructure that was built up in the 1980s is beginning and has been crumbling over some years. Monitoring and surveillance needs to be improved. Despite the success, I mentioned that 80% of the world's children are not being reached with vaccines. The fact that we're only reaching 80% means that 23 to 24 million children remain without access to basic immunization. And as a result, over 1.5 million children are dying from vaccine-preventable diseases, particularly pneumonia and rotavirus, diarrhea caused by the rotavirus itself. There are also huge inequities that remain in developing countries. Some of you may have seen the UNICEF progress report released in the fall that basically confirms that while there has been success, we're still failing to reach the most vulnerable people, where, in fact, the major gains can be achieved. It's where the disease and illness and death are most rampant, and that we're not going to reach the MDGs until we finally address the challenge of reaching the hardest to reach, the marginalized, whether geographically marginalized or politically marginalized, and the most distant. But the good news that is also part of that report is that, in fact, despite what we may have been thinking for many years, that it is actually not very cost-effective, that, in fact, it's the opposite is the case. It is cost-effective. It is where you will achieve the greatest level of outcome because you are, in fact, at that point, tackling the major problem. In terms of moving forward and the strategies and the opportunities that are before us, I take some real solace in knowing that it seems that there's continued high-level leadership in place. The UN Secretary General at the Millennium Development Goals Summit in September made global health again, but particularly maternal and child health, a major part of the summit's outcome. The Every Woman, Every Child Global Strategy, which has attached to it $40 billion in commitments spread out over many years, is, I think, one example of leadership. Its main emphasis is to continue the partnership approaches, finance low-cost, effective solutions, strengthen health systems, and focus on women and girls as drivers of development. We have, on the opportunity side, huge opportunities that Gavi is particularly excited about. Pneumococcal disease and rotavirus together represent over 35% of the child mortality challenge. We can save over 1 million lives a year over the next 4 years if the resources can be made to have those vaccines introduced and administered in over 40 countries for pneumococcal and close to 40 countries for the rotavirus, again, in just 5 years. Last point I will make is that I think that as a result of the, Steve noted the political challenge that we face, particularly in this country, but also in European countries that are suffering from some economic challenges themselves, we have to figure out how to deliver more health for the money. And I think that there are some ways that can actually be done. There has been developed over the last 18 months or so a health systems funding platform, which brings together all of the major players in financing health systems, creates one common source of resource, one common application process, one common accountability framework, which basically gives countries a much simpler access to resources and lowers the burden while placing their national health plans at the very center. My message to the incoming Congress is we're looking forward to a very robust dialogue with them about what works and maybe what doesn't work, what we've learned. But the key point is, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Thank you.
Thank you. Patsy.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Dean, for the kind invitation to join you today. My task is to talk about vaccine-preventable diseases in Minnesota and how that relates to global vaccine issues. I've been in the nursing profession for 30 years and have seen and taken care of many, many children in my career with vaccine-preventable diseases, from meningitis, HIB, strep pneumomeningitis, have had the unfortunate experience of helping parents say goodbye to their children who have died of some of these diseases, taking care of children with pertussis, influenza. They're very real diseases. They're very much still here. We have a lot of young parents, young providers that wonder if these diseases still exist, if they're still around. And so it's easy for me to be passionate about vaccine-preventable diseases and working on vaccine policies that make sense not only for Minnesota, the United States, but globally. I remember working at the children's hospitals and clinics in Minneapolis not long ago where I was through an interpreter talking to a Somali mom, and I was explaining the measles vaccine that we were about to give her 12-month-old. And she put her hand up to me and stopped me and through the interpreter said, "I know very much about measles. This boy was a twin, and he died waiting to come to the United States of measles." And so her experience with measles was profound and urgent, and one that she wanted to make sure never happened again in her family or elsewhere. And I think the good news with vaccines is we've done a good job. We may be victims of our own success in that we have a cohort of young providers and parents that are starting to fear the vaccines themselves more than the disease. It's a small but vocal population that are questioning vaccines. We need to keep our vigilance up, making sure that we don't have increased disease because we've let our guard down on vaccines. I think the turning point for me was the 1990 measles epidemic, and it was a national measles epidemic, and here in Minnesota we had 440 cases of measles, and three children died. All three of those children were Hmong, and I'm not sure if it was just the ease of saying, well, Hmong people don't believe in vaccines, but it certainly wasn't squaring with what I was seeing in my clinical practice. So we set out to try to determine, you know, why was it the Hmong children who died of measles? And we went door to door in public housing, and we talked through interpreters to a variety of people. And it was very clear that they believed in immunizations, they valued them, they wanted to prevent disease, but they didn't have this sense of you're never done with immunizations, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months. And so we set out at that point in time to really raise awareness with parents about the importance of always asking, is my child due for an immunization? We also really set out to try to reach out to providers that every visit is a vaccine visit, that no matter what the child comes to you, that is their health encounter for the month and maybe the year. And so looking at whether or not they're due for vaccines, at every visit is a vaccine visit, because provider missed opportunities in that measles outbreak nationally was a big problem. We've improved that quite a bit. I think the Clinton administration's policy on the vaccine for children's program has made a significant difference, bringing vaccines to those children who are in medical assistance. So that was certainly a turning point. And then working through those years and being able to then be part of the Center for Disease Control Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice. And we are lucky in the United States to have a gathering such as the ACIP, where we will look at all the data, look at what the disease burden is, look at the vaccines, their safety, their efficacy, cost effectiveness, and make U.S. policy. And I was fortunate enough to be a voting member, the first nurse in the United States on that committee from 2004 to 2008. And it was during that time where the rotavirus vaccine was passed in 2006. And at that time, there were, I think, a lot of people in the United States said, well, gosh, you know, do we really need a rotavirus vaccine in the United States? It causes diarrhea, it causes dehydration. You go to your local hospital, you get IV fluids. But the fact of the matter was we had around 50 to 60 children in the United States, despite our good critical care interventions, dying of a preventable disease. And the same is true globally, that rotavirus kills about 500,000 children worldwide. We have a vaccine that's safe, it's effective, and it works well. We had one that was introduced in 1998, and in 1999 it was taken off the market because it was shown to cause intussusception or a bowel problem in children. Some people looked on that as a black eye in the vaccine policy, that did we get vaccines out too early? Is it a vaccine that we don't necessarily need? And I don't look at it that way. I look at it that event really made us realize how good and effective our vaccine monitoring is. After we release a vaccine, we work very closely with children's hospitals, those who care for children. We monitor through post-marketing. We monitor through various centers. And since that event, many, many other surveillance and monitoring measures for vaccine safety have been implemented. So that a lot of very good things came out of that. It took many years, though, for the next rotavirus vaccine to come along in 2006. But that was one of the largest clinical trials for vaccine, 70,000 children in that trial. And the safety and efficacy of that vaccine was well proven. That was implemented in 2006, and bringing it closer to home, around that time at the children's hospitals in St. Paul and Minneapolis where I work, we'd see on average about 250 cases of rotavirus every winter. And when you have only so many beds and you have kids with RSV and influenza and broken legs and leukemia and everything else that we take care of, there were many times where we were out of beds because of the number of kids with rotavirus and other infectious diseases. Many vaccines, once implemented, take about 7 to 10 years to really get providers to work it into their schedule, to really implement it, and to really start seeing a change. Not true for rotavirus. It was implemented in 2006. That year we had 250 cases of rotavirus. Last year we had 9. And so in a very short time, we've seen that vaccine work very, very well here at home in Minnesota. So Garrison Keillor wants us all to remind us that our children are above average, and it doesn't sound too great, and you may not be happy when I say that when it comes to Minnesota vaccine rate, that our children are barely above average. So the national average, and there's many ways to measure this, but when you take a look at how are we doing in Minnesota with vaccines and vaccine-preventable diseases, and you take a slice at what should be done at the two-year-old age, the national average is about 70% of children at around 2 have achieved all the vaccines on schedule. Minnesota is at 72%, so just barely above average. We rank about 17th. We can do a lot better than that. We have done a lot better than that. And one of the things we're concerned about in the last survey was that in many states across the board, in some of the vaccines that have been tried and true, the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, measles, mumps, rubella, we saw a slippage of about 3 percentage points going down instead of going up. Our overall vaccination rate is high when you look at kindergartners. We're successful by the time kids do get to kindergarten, and much of that perhaps has to do with school mandates and some of the public policy that really were implemented. Our first state public policy on vaccines was 1967 to make sure that all kids entering kindergarten had an MMR, at least one at the time. It was just one MMR. So our public policy on mandates does help us. It's sort of our catch point to say, do we know how our kids are doing? Are they well vaccinated? So at kindergarten they are, but where those vaccines count is the younger kids, to be able to make sure that we're getting them on time. We've got a ways to go. And I think some of us who do a lot of work with vaccine safety, talking to parents, talking to providers, know that this small and vocal group of people who are vaccine hesitant or even out and out anti-vaccine have a tool called the internet. And they talk and they communicate and they blog and tweet and everything else about vaccines. And we need to do the same thing in terms of how life-saving, second to clean water, there's nothing that saved more lives in the world than vaccines. And that we need to make sure that not only today that we raise our rate, but we sustain our vaccine rate here in Minnesota. And I do think that then looking forward, we can take those successes that we've seen with rotavirus here in Minnesota and the United States, going from hundreds of cases every winter in children's hospitals across the country to zero in a matter of a few years has been quite remarkable. And we need to make sure that we keep our eye on both of those. It's sort of a dual road. And in vaccine world, we have our term called herd immunity or community immunity. And we talk a lot about you vaccinate one person, you're not just protecting that person, you're protecting perhaps an infant too young to be immunized, or an elderly person whose immune system is not what it used to be, or a child who's on chemotherapy, whose immune system is unable to fight. So making sure that we think of our community locally, in that family, in that community, in that state, but also globally, that we take our vaccines globally. All of these diseases are simply one international business trip away, one study abroad away, one international adoption away from being right here in our neighborhood. Children's, I think our interpreters translated last year 44 different languages. And we have on site multiple interpreters. Our highest top three are Spanish, Hmong, and Somali, in that order. And so we aren't all Norwegian bachelor farmers, as Garrison Keillor likes to think. We have to make sure that we think of ourselves as a globally connected community. So besides keeping an eye on local as well as global, what are the things we have to do? We really have to look at vaccine financing. We're in a big challenge with increasingly good vaccines, new vaccines, recent vaccines. I think in the 4 years that I was a voting member on the ACIP, we had a record number of new vaccines and new recommendations implemented, all of them life-saving, all of them important, all of them not inexpensive. And the amount of money that goes into vaccines themselves, but the amount that is increasing, whereas the amount, the federal budget towards vaccine is either steady or going down. And so we're seeing this increasing gap, and it's really putting pressure on state health departments to try to determine how do we decide which vaccines through our Vaccines for Children's program, through the C317 programs, how do we implement these programs with this financial challenge? And I think globally, as was mentioned, there's infrastructure challenges constantly. The rotavirus vaccine is very simple to give. It's a quick squirt in the mouth, but it doesn't want to be frozen, and it doesn't want to be at room temperature. It needs to be cold. And so if that cold chain is broken, that vaccine is ineffective. And at the same time, other injectable vaccines, you need the supplies, you need the staff, the people trained to be able to safely give those injectable vaccines. So new vaccines, new methods, edible vaccines, building them into our bananas, our rice, our tea that we drink, having new ways of delivering them, new patches, for example. Can you imagine getting your flu vaccine in a patch that comes in an envelope to your house and you just put it on? That would be ways that could happen not only locally, but internationally. And I think just having our good political will, and again, continuing to realize that we are all one community when it comes to infectious diseases. And my last Garrison Keillor quote is that he says, nothing we ever do for children is ever wasted. And I would say every child everywhere, we need to make sure that they're vaccinated. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Trevor?
I'm the only guy with a PowerPoint. Good morning, everybody. So Steve's got us on the 8-minute cycle here, and I've got 8 slides, so with a little bit of forbearance, I should be able to hit it pretty close. Dean Atwood, thank you very much for your leadership, and Steve, Johanna from CSIS, thanks very much for bringing us all together. I think our perspective is going to be slightly different than the colleagues that have come before me, and it's going to be about non-communicable disease. I think most people in the room know Medtronic, but just want to make sure that we have it all up front. When we're talking about global health, here are facts. Not only are we operating in 120 countries commercially, our technologies are obviously found in a lot of other countries where we don't operate commercially because of medical missions, because of donation programs, because people may be wearing a pacemaker in the diplomatic service and end up in countries where we don't have commercial operations, those type of things. Obviously today, hopefully you're as proud as I am that today actually we're the world's largest in the medical device field. We obviously have tremendous amounts of facilities. When people talk about suppliers, Boeing usually has about 20,000 suppliers, and we have about 72,000 suppliers, just so you have a general sense of the complexity of the enterprise, which is just around your, where you live and where you work. About of our activities are about 40% oriented towards international, but I would say that the probably the most important initiative that we're doing right now is truly focusing really over the past 5 months, sincerely we've done it for a lot longer, but really a sort of an unequivocal focus on emerging markets. So everyone talks about non-communicable disease and think that change is coming, but I think few know that change is already here. And I think that's what I'd like to talk just a bit about. I would say that that within the public health debate right now, non-communicable disease is one of, if not probably the top topic that's now being discussed. But what are non-communicable diseases, first of all? And that's very important for people that don't have health backgrounds and may have a health interest. Obviously, it's not infectious diseases. And then there's some confusion, and I would guarantee you that actually there's a lot of confusion at the senior levels of the U.S. administration about these type of issues. So if you're confused, I got to tell you that you're not alone. There are a lot of people in the same position back in Washington, D.C. But how are non-communicable diseases different than chronic? Chronic diseases, for example, HIV, AIDS, TB, can actually end up becoming chronic diseases. These are states that you oftentimes do not get rid of. Rheumatoid arthritis, things that you're going to need some form of management or treatment for a long time, hopefully. Not, but the reality may be quite different. And we deal with a lot of, I call it mythology, when it comes to non-communicable diseases. Aren't they all just lifestyle diseases? Can't we all just wake up in the morning, and if we ran, 50 kilometers a day and started to eat, crabgrass, aren't these just simply preventable? Now, you may be thinking, and I love the laughs, because we're still dealing with those issues, but unfortunately, those same laughs are being heard at health ministries all around the world. And I think here at the school, soon-to-be school, you'll have a great opportunity to help shape some of these things. Are they are they diseases that are uniquely of the rich? Let's talk about that. Okay. Sorry. Well, it comes out a lot better than it did even online. But this is from The Economist last year. Take a look at the breakdown of actual death. Disability may be actually different. In fact, of course, disability, which obviously takes in many forms, could actually make this a lot more stark. But take a look at it, and we'll move on quickly so we get under our 8 minutes. But let's talk about the facts. Non-communicable diseases today account for a great amount of deaths in every region except for sub-Saharan Africa. In fact, I sat down about 7 weeks ago with the head of the Afro region of the WHO. And if you ask him, and if you ask almost any health minister that I've sat down with recently, this is the topic that is keeping them up at night. It may be very different from funding flows and available funds or epidemiology oftentimes, but the fact of the matter is this is what keeps them, and it's the double burden of disease. It's not saying that infectious disease are unimportant. It is that in medium and low-income countries, they're being fraught with the double burden of disease, that is, the coexistence, really, of infectious disease alongside other type of diseases. And in fact, he was estimating, this is Luis Sambo, who's an Angolan, that under 7 years, actually, that will do an epidemiological inversion, even in Africa, if you can imagine that. 60% of all deaths globally are attributable to non-communicable disease. But here's your answer to the low and middle-income question, or is this disease uniquely of the rich countries? I would say absolutely not. 80% of them occur in actually low and medium income countries, those which actually have the least ability to actually deal with these. A recent Center for Global Development that everyone knows, very well-respected think tank in Washington, my colleague Rachel Nugent, said that less than 5% of global aid flows right now are dedicated to non-communicable disease. If we take it a country like Russia, 86% of deaths are attributable to non-communicable diseases, but probably less than 1% of that USAID budget today is focused in this area. Now, I don't want to be unfair. There's a lot of learning for us all. Asked us some of these questions. How well are public health schools around the country actually prepared for this challenge? It's got to start here. It's got to start at other public health schools. Colleagues in the World Bank, et cetera, very, very important as well. But outside of Yale, I've not been able to find, and I'd be very open to being corrected, do not have a real focus on non-communicable diseases. So what are we teaching? Small groups of aficionados, and I call them small groups. Betty McCollum actually was one of the individuals who, about a year and a half ago, we co-sponsored a small event on the Hill talking about non-communicable diseases. I don't necessarily call her in that group, but there are other people that are actually recognizing outside of that group of aficionados. It should not be a small group of aficionados, for lack of better terminology. Conferences are breaking out everywhere. Focus of CSIS. Is increasingly in this particular area. The Global Health Council will actually have non-communicable diseases as the top theme for their annual meeting in 2011. We predicted, those of us that were working in this particular area, and that is public health colleagues as well as the private sector, thought that it would take the best part of a decade, but the fact of the matter is in April, that changed. And now we have 9 months, let alone the best part of a decade. A price tag, and I think this is what people are looking for. What's the economic price tag? What is it that this is costing in terms of economic productivity, et cetera, et cetera? A lot of those things are still being worked on. I think, to be frank, most people are still in a complete state of shock, and I would include it myself in that. We were unsuccessful in actually predicting how quickly this would change. I'm not talking about epidemiology, because that's been changing for a long, long time. But the fact of the matter is, but the recognition of the UN General Assembly that this was important took a very small amount of time. Major donors, including our friends at the Gates Foundation, and they're doing fantastic work. There's nothing to be critical towards the Gates Foundation, but not terribly focused on non-communicable disease, very, very much focused in other areas, very, very promising areas, but a lot of other organizations in the same particular area. And I would say that we are poorly prepared at the multilateral level right now and very well poorly prepared at government level to deal with some of these challenges. Where are we going from here? In my final slide, non-communicable disease summit will occur with heads of state likely in September 2011 at the UN General Assembly. Now this, something that was actually supported by 130 countries, was only passed in April of this year, if you can imagine that. I think it's going to be far-ranging, and it's going to be, it gives us all a lot of time for pause, but frankly, a lot of analysis and a lot of action. Jamaica and Luxembourg are actually the co-chairs of this, and I think it's going to be a very interesting road forward here. I think that the important thing to think about going forward in terms of thematics are prevention and control, and I think that's the important thing. Obviously, non-communicable diseases are not entirely preventable. There's no question about that. But prevention, clearly, in our particular opinion, has to be a part of it. Our colleagues in the private sector, in the food industry, in other industries, all have to be a part of this discussion. We put a lot of focus on this because we feel that it builds out health systems in general. It helps doctor training. It helps a lot of capacity. A lot of that capacity has frankly been built by the infectious disease industry and has a very positive impact in the context of non-communicable disease control and prevention as well. We, that is Medtronic Foundation, it may not have hit the local papers here, but actually became, I believe, the largest corporate donor in this space about 4 weeks ago when Bill Hawkins, my CEO and chairman, together with Bill Clinton at this Clinton Global Initiative, put $1 million commitment on the table to something called the Non-Communicable Disease Alliance, which is an organization of organizations, really, within the respiratory illnesses, cancer, Within the heart area and also within the diabetes area just a few weeks ago. The private sector response has started World Economic Forum, the Clinton Global Initiatives, and others. But the fact of the matter is we need everyone in this discussion. We need academics. We need a variety of other parties that can really help us think through, that is, the private sector, not alone in thinking. There's no question that the private sector has to be tremendously responsive. But, you know, we that are living the sort of the day-to-day grind may not always have the best thoughts, and clearly we oftentimes don't have the best perspective. We're part of the solution, but we're not the only ones there. So I do invite the Humphrey School and others here to embark on this journey with us, because it's going to be a very intense next 8 to 9 months, and all great minds are welcome. Thank you.
Thank you all. We've heard a lot of opinion on a span of issues, which I think brings across just how much falls under global health when you begin to talk about it. And there are many other subjects that we chose not to treat. I just want to recap a bit here. Mike, you put a big focus on the whole question, the long-term challenge of resistance, microbial evolution and resistance, and population growth. And I took away from what you said that this is where we should be centering our thinking over the long term, putting a focus. And perhaps when we get into the discussion, we can talk a bit more about, okay, what do you do then around advancing resistance to existing antibiotics. On the vaccine front, where we had two speakers, it's a story that is really about the emergence of new opportunities here. We have on the pneumococcal and on the rotavirus, we have new technologies. We have proven, we have a proven case and a consensus emerging around this as a best buy. This is these options as ones that are affordable. We know how to do them. They bring broad benefits, and the question is how do you create the financing, the predictability, and the institutional outreach, the access? How do you build public confidence and trust in this as a top priority? And this has been one of the paradoxes or enigmatic aspects of global health, is that an organization like Gavi and the vaccine agenda is one that has not become quite the front and center top line issue that when you look at it, it should be. And there's a frustrating aspect of that. And why is that, despite all of the arguments? And perhaps some of them are ones that Patsy has alluded to in terms of ambivalence and in terms of the difficulty in making the case. But there are other reasons. On the NCDs, on the non-communicable diseases, This is an issue that's pushing forward right now, as Trevor was talking about, the high-level meeting that the Secretary General will be calling in New York next September. It's a very crowded agenda right now in global health, in a period in which resources are not expanding. They're either flat or perhaps at risk of retracting. And so how do you make your best case that, in fact, there is a profound demographic and epidemiological shift going on, in which these diseases of diabetes, of cancer, of cardiovascular disorders are hitting populations in low and middle income countries at a level that rival, if not exceed, the classic infectious disease combination of malaria, TB, HIV, and others. There, I think we're at an early point, and I don't think this September conference is going to be the last word. This is really a process of educating and beginning a conversation around the kinds of things that can be done. And I think that we're actually in a much better position today than we were a few years ago. We have a framework convention on tobacco control. We have a consciousness around salt consumption. We know that exercise matters. We have a Gates and Bloomberg Foundations partnered on a massive scale on the tobacco control issue. There are things that are out there that didn't exist just a few years ago to help us get some progress forward and get some priority around this. And I think if we come out of next September with some very achievable broad goals, it will be a major step forward, just like if we are able to elevate the concern around vaccines and making a big push. That's another big win that's out there, just as if we can get a focus on the growing problem of resistance on antibiotics and what kind of policy interventions are going to be needed. Let me ask each of you to sort of say a few words, and then I want to open for the balance of our time to our audience. Alex, you want to say a few words on the vaccine challenges?
Yeah. We have spent the first decade of Gavi's existence focusing on the relationship between the partners who are all of the major players in immunization, UNICEF, WHO, the World Bank, developing countries, donor countries, and civil society, as well as pharmaceuticals. Over this next decade ahead of us, I think we need to, as we're rolling out these new vaccines, build a level of awareness in donor countries much more broadly around the opportunity that Steve just commented on. We haven't really had the bandwidth to do that. But I do think that there is a significant level of progress that's been achieved in public health already with immunization. It's saving 3 million plus lives a year as we speak, and the potential to do even more is very real, very, very major. I wanted to sort of comment on what you had said earlier, Mark, like on the population control issue. One of the things that I explored and learned a bit about early on in my years at UNICEF during the takeoff of the child survival and development revolution is the relationship between increased survivability of children, reduced child mortality, and reduced population growth. And I do think that if we are able to, both on the prevention and control side or treatment side, to do a much better job and bring down mortality and create essentially a more reliable health system that delivers interventions like immunization, that we will see population rates decline even further, which will be a break against that particular challenge.
Mike? Thank you. I think the issues before us today really do have to be divided in between now, the next decade, and the next generation. And I fear that we blur those together far too often, because as a result of that, we are always planning for the last public health war, in a sense. And let me offer some suggestions that, first of all, Alex, you're exactly right, and I want to celebrate the issue of the impact of immunization. I've spent a great deal of my career on immunizations, promoting it, and trying to move forward with that. And so, therefore, we have a model of what is happening today. But what is the model that's going to be there tomorrow to provide that same technology into that world? 10 years ago, I gave a lecture at this school in which I predicted polio eradication would never occur. And I, at the time, was, of course, I might as well have been the worst person in the world. And it wasn't because of the technology. It was because of the politics. It was because of the world developments. It was the stability or instability of world governments. It was 38 failing states and the number growing quickly. And it was all about that part of the world that I was talking about. And I think when I refer back to Alex and talking about where do we need to be for the future, I still stand by my statement as we are now 9 years beyond the predicted date of polio eradication. We actually have 4 endemic countries, 4 countries with outbreaks, and 8 countries where we've had recent introduction, and we're falling farther behind, and donor fatigue is growing. And the point I'm raising there is not because I don't want it to happen. I want it to happen, but we have to be realistic. And we have to achieve what we can achieve, when we can achieve it, and where we can achieve it. And then we have to consider that a success. As the world population grows 2 more billion people over the next 3 decades, immunizations and trying to move them into the urban blight of the world which, as you know, 2 years ago was a very historic day in this world because technically half the world now lives in an urban area as opposed to all of history where more than half the people lived in rural areas. The public health services to deliver in the urban blight of the developing world is absolutely astronomically complicated. And I think what we've achieved there has been nothing short of a miracle. And so all the successes Alex has talked about are real, they're important, but we're at a tipping point, just as we are with anti-infectives. We don't have any new anti-infectives coming down the pike, and it's not just investment. We thought 5 years to 10 years ago with the new genomics revolution that we'd suddenly discover all these new ways to attack microbes. And it turns out we didn't find any new ways. We thought we were going to have easy drugs out there. It was just more investment. It wasn't about money. It was about the physics of science and understanding genomics and microbes. And so I think that part of what I'm trying to reflect today is the reality of the world, just as I did 10 years ago and I doubted that polio eradication would occur, not because of the vaccine, but because of humans. Let me just say one last thing, and I think, Trevor, your lecture was exactly to the point of what I was trying to make a point earlier. We'll always have a top 10 causes of death. If someone dies from a heart-related condition at age 45 that should never have occurred, to me that is a tremendous failure. But because the population's aging, a lot of people are going to die of heart disease at 85 or 90, and that's not a failure. We shouldn't be counting those numbers up there as a bad thing. We should be saying that was a success. And what I worry about is that we're now approaching chronic diseases like we got to eliminate them all. And the point of it is we can't. We won't. We're going to die of something, okay? And maybe the ideal of death would be at 95 and we die from overintelligence, okay? Wouldn't that be wonderful? You know? But the point of it is we're going to have these. And so therefore, and I think even, let me just comment, I have to defend our university. I'd be happy to sit down with you and go through all the School of Public Health and their major focuses on non-communicable diseases. This university is internationally famous for its cardiovascular disease work in School of Public Health, Mr. Fit, all the work that was done here, et cetera. We have a major cancer initiative here. I can go through at least 15 Schools of Public Health I thought of. So I'd love to sit down with you and update you on your only school issue. But I think equally important is what you say is true, is we're going to start seeing these issues of chronic diseases become more and more as the population ages, and that's true. But we need a way to figure out which of those are successes and which are failures. And we need to attack the failures, and we need to try to improve upon the quality of life and the quantity of life in those failures, but not get caught up in what are those end-of-life death issues that occur that we should all count as successes and try to use those to back into why we need to put more money into something, because I think that that's going to be a backwards way to approach it. We should be looking at years of life lost. We should be looking at quality years of life adjusted. We should be looking at those kinds of things. Then I think we can start talking about ways of where we should be investing for a better world.
Trevor, can you speak to the issue of, you know, in the current environment, how do you make the case to an American public with 10% unemployment and a $1.3 trillion deficit and a lot of anxiety, how do you make the case that that Washington should pick up the NCD agenda outside our borders and in low and middle income countries as a priority in our global health approaches? We've already got a global health approach that's predominantly HIV, TB, malaria, that's picking up maternal and child health, $10 billion a year. A lot of people anxious about preserving and sustaining that, and now you're saying, wait a second, there's an epidemiological and demographic transition happening, and you're going to wind up with 45-year-olds having strokes and premature death from heart attacks. You're going to have, so how do you make that case to an American public?
Yeah, and Mike, no question. We have a lot to thank you for our work at Medtronic over the many, many years. So there's no question about it. There's a huge amount of collaboration that's going on. It's going to continue to go on. But to your point, Steve, you said make it a priority. That was your question, as opposed to have it on the radar screen, which would be more what I would say, to be completely frank. I don't know that we can make the argument, neither should we, particularly as a profit-making company in a public context here, to be saying that this should be the priority. I am saying, look at the statistics. Make sure that we at least have good epidemiological data. We've got a government, and I am a registered independent, that does claim, and to a certain extent does have the legitimacy behind it that it wants to become listening, a listening government. It's listening to other governments around the world about truly what keeps them up at night. I'm saying include those much more formally in how we craft our aid policy. I think that America can do a lot of good, Steve, without dispensing almost a single dollar in different terms. Some in the world, and this may not be entirely correct, but look back to the Western Hemisphere is where a lot of these trends have started from. I think by the way, they look back to that same Western Hemisphere, and particularly the United States and Canada, for leadership on best practices when it comes to management of non-communicable disease. A lot of other countries, let's say in Africa, you ask Minister XYZ what kills his population. Many of the African ministers will not know what actually kills their population or what that epidemiologic. I'm not saying in some countries there will be, but in other countries there will not be. And I think that we can be a big help in helping to even collect the data, share best practices. Mm-hmm. I do believe that the U.S. flag has to be flying very high on this. U.S. signed on with 130 countries. Some doubted that they would actually do that, and I think that the president specifically should come in September, but alongside other leaders and share best practices in the first case, and have it included as a part of the agenda, as opposed to simply making it necessarily number one or number two, whatever it is, but in a health systems discussion.
Thank you. Patsy, on this question around public confidence or trust and mm-hmm. communications to an American public, that these work, that they are not threats, what is the strategy that actually is effective in that regard? Because we have had backlash. We have had decline of uptake in key populations. We've seen a worsening of infections in mm-hmm. some key areas. How do you what do you know as you look at this?
Well, I think the main thing is to continue to educate. I think educating young children, educating parents, educating providers, public-private partnerships at the local, state, national, international level have been very, very helpful. I think that one of the, as you look back in history, we have examples of where we let our guard down, or say the entire country of Japan, for example, in the late 70s, said we think there's more problems with pertussis vaccine than the good that it's providing. So they wholeheartedly stopped immunizing their children in Japan with DT whole cell pertussis. And what happened? Reemergence of pertussis. You know, thousands of cases, thousands of deaths, and realize this was gone because we were doing a good job at vaccinating. So we don't want to have that experiment. We've already had that. And that's why prevention is difficult, because you do all this work and nothing happens. The epidemics don't happen. The outbreaks don't happen. And I think, just to kind of reflect on the theme of this panel here, what I'm hearing today that I'm interested in opening up and hearing your thoughts is competing priorities. How do we make public policy locally, nationally, internationally around these competing priorities, whether they're antibiotic resistance, vaccine preventable diseases, infectious diseases that don't have a vaccine? I didn't mention that many of my patients have our children with HIV, and Minnesota has a unique spot of being one of the states in the country where we're actually increasing the number of babies that are perinatally mother to child exposed to HIV. And it's not because we give bad medical care here. We give terrific medical care. It's because we have so many international immigrants and refugees, and the moms are HIV positive, come here and have children. And so we have a whole system around trying to make sure that baby born here in the U.S. Does not have HIV, and we're doing a good job at that. But Minnesota has that unique challenge in our HIV population. So infectious diseases that don't have a vaccine yet, and there's not one in the near term for HIV. And then, as was presented, those that are chronic diseases. So our priorities are many. The budget is few, and we have to make intelligent decisions.
Thank you. Why don't we take a few comments and questions from the audience? What I suggest we do is take three or four and then come back. So there's a hand up there, and there's a hand up there. And please,
Please identify yourself and please be very succinct. Thank you.
I'm Phil Peterson from the medical school, and on a word of optimism, the International Medical Education Research Program, now in its 13th year, we've seen, as have all schools, a wave of enthusiasm among young people for global health. It's really quite remarkable. My question, however, is to Mike Osterholm. I believe you share the view that in terms of priorities of vaccines, you can make influenza a very, very high priority in terms of what it does annually. The pandemic in 1918 that killed 50 million people, most of those died in the developing world, as I understand it. So fortunately, we got through the H1N1 epidemic, and now we're going to be relaxed again. Comment on the efficacy of the influenza vaccine. What are the facts, in fact, and the need for a better influenza vaccine in terms of a priority?
Thank you. That's excellent. Yes, right here.
The comment was made that there was... Sorry?
Your name?
My name is Paul Vleem. I'm a student here at the Humphrey. And the comment was made that the push that was made in the 1970s and the 1980s regarding systems and processes of distributing these vaccines is starting to fall apart. And I think we all agree that communicable and non-communicable diseases are important and they need to be put out there. I'm curious what is being done on the system side of things to make sure that the work that we're doing now is going to last and is not going to fall apart. And what have we learned from what happened in the 70s and 80s to ensure that the work we're doing is going to continue many decades into the future?
Thank you. We have other comments or questions? There are two right here. There's one right there. Hold for a second. Yes, please.
Yeah, my name's Jane Mailing Cady, and I'm from the McKnight Foundation. And I was very excited that this day was going to be talking about food and health, because you see in many places that is a conversation that people are really trying to figure out the relationship between and how they influence each other. And so in that, there's a growing amount of research and policy and program that's really saying, you know, the way we produce our food and what we eat really impacts our health. And so I was glad that Dr. Osterholm mentioned that a little bit. And mostly this would probably be for Trevor and Dr. Osterholm, but about how you are using that analysis to look at the food, the way we produce it, how it impacts people and the environment in talking about NCDs and even, you know, the communicable diseases as well. So I look forward to all your comments on that. Thank you.
Okay, if you can hold for one moment, we'll do a quick second round. Alex, speak for a second to the systems issue, and then Mike, there was a Phil Peterson's question around efficacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the good news on the infrastructure around immunization and immunization systems is that I think that there has been a recognition developed over the last 10 years, but even more, the last 5 years, of the importance of health systems overall within the donor community. And I think that donors are starting to recognize that as they provide support for various interventions, and it was very much a, you know, the history has been very much sort of verticalized, specific disease focus, specific outcomes associated with just one disease, to looking at a more integrated approach and recognizing that it is, at the end of the day, the same health system, the same health group of health workers. It's the same, you're relying on the same system to achieve an awful lot. So that's very helpful. I think that means there'll be more support. I'm particularly, as we think about sustainability, obviously the investments that countries themselves are need to make is important. For Gavi, it's focused on the poorest countries in the world, under 1,000 GNI per capita. In many of these countries, while they are beginning to contribute through their co-financing of vaccines and in other ways to the success of the program, at the end of the day, until a great deal of development takes place, they're going to be reliant largely on external support for many things, and particularly around health, the maintenance of the health system. But it's that recognition of its importance. It's the recognition of how to do that in a more effective way, better aid than was provided in the past. Also thinking in much longer term, not just sort of annual catch-as-catch-can, color of the day kind of support, but thinking about multi-year financing for all the critical aspects of the health system, including the cold chain.
Patsy, can you speak to this issue from a domestic standpoint about building systems?
Exactly. I think it's a great question and an important one. I think one is this whole notion of access to care. Do people have access to routine medical care, and where is that? And building the healthcare home or the medical home. But we know that people move. They move within cities. They move within the United States. And so the next step is really looking at electronic medical records, immunization registries, and having them locally in the state, and then hopefully someday building state to state so that if a child does move to a different location, we know what their immunization history is, and we've built that, and we can see where the gaps are. I think better public health surveillance. I mean, Minnesota has one of the best state public health departments, and we often are seen as, how do they know that they have a child with polio? Or how do they know that they had 5 HIB cases? It's because we have excellent surveillance here. And that comes from terrific relationships between the clinicians who are taking care of the patients, if you will, and the state health departments and local as well, building that surveillance system so that when we see it in our hospitals, we know it, we diagnose it, we treat it, we report it, and then that will send triggers to be able to do better surveillance in the state and then nationally. So I do think it has to do with really having a good local and national infrastructure.
Thank you. Mike, can you speak to the vaccine efficacy question that Phil put forward?
Yeah. Can I just add one comment to this conversation? Because
sure.
I think this is a really critical one. Again, let's talk about physics. 64.9% of the dollar that went to Washington last year was accounted for in Social Security, Medicaid, interest on the debt, and non-discretionary military spending. If you think about that, that is the sum total of how much revenue we brought in. Everything else was borrowed last year, and that covers every other thing we spent on, including all public health. Last year, we spent $1.09 per $100 sent in on anything to do with NIH, CDC, FDA, et cetera, even though FDA controls one-third of our country's budget by what it regulates. Point being is, if you look at every projection we have, and very involved on the Hill right now in some of the discussions, we're going to take huge hits. Right now, one out of every 21 citizens in Minnesota are in Medicaid. One out of every 21. And we have a $6 billion deficit facing us next year, and the budget issues are going to be huge. The state health department took a big hit this year. Nothing compared to what they're going to take over the next several years. And so the physics of support for public health infrastructure domestically or internationally is going to be severely challenged. Mm-hmm. And again, I only say that because then we have to plan accordingly. You know, if I only have one fire truck to send to that 4-alarm fire, I just got to know that so that as the incident commander, I can now plan for what I'm going to do, as opposed to if I know all 9 trucks are coming. And I think that one of the discussions we can be most helpful with here today is to try to further a lay of the land, just what's the best guesstimate we've got or what we've got in front of us. So when I talk about immunizations and failing states, let me just add one piece. You draw a map today of the Americas and show me where Aedes aegypti mosquito is, a very important vector for a number of diseases. And let me show you a map of 1930. And then let me show you a map of 1970. 1930, it was widespread through a number of parts of the Americas. By 1970, we had it down to 3 local areas. And then infrastructure went to hell. Today, it is much more widespread than it was in 1930 in the Americas. And unfortunately, a sizable proportion are now resistant to the common pesticides we use. That is just an inevitable issue of vector-borne diseases. Well, whether it's immunizations, whether it's safe water, all these things are challenges coming down. So my message isn't to just depress all of you. It's to say we got to know the lay of the land. As the incident commander trying to respond, we just need to know what's before us. And so in that light, flu vaccine. Many of us predicted flu vaccine would be a bust during the next pandemic. Next pandemic comes. We have a beautiful graph I showed at a meeting Phil was at on Friday where the arrival of the flu vaccine occurred well after the second major peak of the pandemic. So we got a lot of vaccine out in the end, but it was well after the fact. Point is, we still have a 1950s technology of a vaccine that has even marginal protection for many populations. We need a new flu vaccine. We need one that basically could cover the world. We had no vaccine for the developing world whatsoever. Had this been a 1918-like pandemic, we would not have had it on time, and we wouldn't have had any anyway, even for the developing world. So there's a lot of infrastructure issues there that we need to, but now that's got to play back into the realities of what I just talked about. Who's going to provide the support for that to bring it forward? What's the regulatory mindset? The FDA, we have a bill on food safety right now that's moving through the Senate that if it doesn't pass in the next 2 days, likely it's not going to pass this lame duck session. It's dead. Even if it does pass the Senate, unlike the House companion bill, there's no money for the FDA to do anything. It's just new authorities. Well, the bottom line is the FDA as an agency is but a ghost of what it once was relative to support. So from a regulatory science standpoint, our new vaccines we want, there's nobody there at home to deal with the regulatory science issues. They have been gutted. So again, what's the reality of the future? Give me new vaccines, but where's the regulatory science going to come from to approve those vaccines when the FDA has no money to do it? And so I think it's far too often we get to these meetings, we want to feel good about what we've done. And we should celebrate our successes. But we are not doing anybody a favor if we just don't lay out as honestly as we can what's the reality of next year, next decade, and next generation. And I think that's what I find sometimes frustrating to me being in academia is, you know, far too often our damn heads are in the clouds, and what we really need is to have our boots knee-deep into the muck. And I think it's the combination of the two that hopefully will allow us to have a reasonable opportunity to make a real difference in the lives of our kids and our grandkids.
Thank you. Trevor, can you speak to this question around food and how does food relate to the NCD agenda, since this is something that many people
I was hoping I would get
at.
That one as a vegetarian. Vegetarian of 23 years. You are what you eat. Clearly.
You look like a vegetarian.
Maybe I'm not your walking, talking best example, but there's no question there's an interrelationship. But I've got to believe that at some point, I mean, medical technology companies, as an example, or those that are doing therapies in the non-communicable disease area, I think I think we have to unwind the somewhat common perception, and that may not be in the United States, but it may be elsewhere, that somehow the food companies and those that are doing therapies are in collaboration with each other. I think that's one big myth that exists. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that some people walking and talking around think that somehow, you know, we own a part of Coca-Cola or they own a part of us. And that's clearly not the case. But to my point, and this is right from my presentation, we need to be talking about prevention before we talk about control. We need to be talking, very, very specifically about what needs to be done. But there are going to be limits. I mean, and we can start in our own company. We do. If you looked at when I was at the WHO and actually held a kind of a mini summit with about 14 people at WHO, one of the secret questions that they asked me afterwards were, do you guys actually believe in prevention? And I said, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, at some point. I mean, the mythology around non-communicable disease and food, et cetera. And then what I did was I did kind of something very daring. I started to send them our daily newsletter and ask them to measure how many times in our internal communications we actually talked about health, about our diet, internal communications to the company, right? I didn't pass them on any confidential stuff, but you get my point. That discussion went away very, very quickly. But I think that we need to be a lot more explicit publicly about these type of things. I think we're open to a lot of ideas. But again, medical technology is oftentimes at the receiving end of bad practices on the front end.
We're getting towards the end of our time. We had two questions right here. I'd like to just take those quickly, come back to our speakers and ask them to just wrap up, and then we'll move on to our next panel. Yes, please.
Yes, my name's Martha Cashman. Nice to see you again, Alex. Nice to see you, Mike.
Good to see you, Martha.
And I want to go back to what Mike had to say at the very beginning, which is the whole issue of population imbalance. We're outstripping our ability to feed an ever-growing population. and we're also destroying our water resources. And if you don't have some sort of balance and intelligent dialogue and strategy for addressing those, which are political hot potatoes, quite frankly, especially population issues, then you never really get to the point of, you know, stabilizing global health. In fact, you go beyond the tipping point, and you've got deaths and people living on top of each other. I hate to go back to it, but I watched the movie, again, Soylent Green, a pretty frightening scenario, which, quite frankly, is not that hard to imagine at times. So I guess, you know, and then if you look at that and you take into account our new Congress, and I guess I'd like to hear some comments about from a political agenda and a funding agenda, if you look at what's been out there now for recommendations to address the deficit, you know, what's the hope? Mike, you talk about a gutted FDA. I mean, it's not just FDA, it's almost all of the agencies. You know, how do we address these issues politically?
Thank you. At our luncheon meeting with Congressman Ellison and Congresswoman McCollum and Brian Atwood, there'll be quite a bit of discussion around this question of what's current environment and likely options, and how do you advance a development and global health and food security agenda in that particular changing context.
Just say one thing that I think historically one of the problems has been is that we're chasing kind of one agenda, whether it's immunizations or it's infrastructure development or it's agriculture, and somehow or another we don't keep the various aspects of human development in some sort of correlational balance, and as a result resources get shifted out of one initiative into another at the expense of everything else.
Steve, can I just address that head on real quick, because there is one answer. I think the single medicine we need for the world, and if you look at all the base data that supports it, it's the empowerment of women. It singly is the single most important thing we could do. If you look in the developing world, and Alex was exactly right, when you drop infant mortality rates, and you're doing that because you're dropping fertility rates. And fertility rates drop when you educate women. And when you basically make it so that a third of the developing world women are not walking 10 more miles or more a day to get water for their family. Mm-hmm. And it all fits together. It's not about high tech. It's not about all these things. And we can show when you drop mortality rates, infant mortality rates, the SES starts to change. The ability of a society to respond in a what we consider a developed world kind of construct, all is there. So I think you're exactly right, and none of us talked about the fact that probably the single most important thing we do is empower women, but we should. That's what it's all about.
Thank you. We're getting to the end of our time. Did you have one quick point,
I think
point,
this is fairly focused, so I'll make it short. My name is Sala, and I work with a very infant university of integrated medicine in Ghana. And many of you have mentioned the need to build the infrastructure of healthcare professionals. So I'm just curious to know where that may be taking place and how you see the future of that.
Thank you. We're going to need to just do quick wrap-up because we've got our next panel. And realize, you know, some of these conversations could take place afterwards on the margins here. Patsy, do you want to just offer closing? Let's just go down with quick closing remarks.
Thanks, everyone, for your comments. It's economics, it's healthcare, it's just general health and well-being, and it's local, national, and international, and keeping that big picture in mind is really critical.
Trevor?
I've taken up enough time already. Thank you.
Mike, do you have any closing words?
Thank you, and if you want an outcome judgment of what we did or don't do here in general, what does it mean for our kids and our grandkids? That should be the common denominator we think about all the time.
Yes.
30 seconds, I would just say that maintaining America's leadership in global development has required a bipartisan consensus always, and we're going to have to figure out how to secure that again.
Thank you all for your engagement and your patience. This has been a wonderfully rich panel. Thank you.